Trudy asked me to give this talk a couple months ago, and she said, just talk about, you know, like, what inspires you, you know, how did you happen to get involved in it, and what do you do, and what does the Climate Salon do in Boulder, and, you know, just kind of get the conversation going. And my history of loving nature goes back to when I was, you know, that big. It's lifelong. I grew up in a small town in Ohio, and we lived on the edge of town, and I could walk from up to the corner and then into the woods and across the street and over the hill, and I was out in the country, and there were ponds and forests and all that stuff. So I grew up living in all of that and loving it, and always caring about the environment. And often feeling like we were, as a species, we were living out of sync with it somehow. Too many cars, too many people, too many houses, too much stuff. It's not enough nature for my taste. And then it was about 17 years ago, I calculated today, that I started getting interested in the topic of climate change, because I was going to Barnes & Noble and I was noticing these books with titles like The Heat Is On. And, well, what's that about? And I started reading about the problem of global warming and getting more interested and wondering, you know, why, I mean, this sounds really bad, really serious, and we're not talking about it. You know, we're on this, who mentioned the word slow-moving train or something like that? Yeah, it's like we're on this train that's about to go off the rails, and shouldn't we maybe do something about that? So anyway, sitting for years with kind of frustration about not being able to talk about climate change, I mean, it's not exactly, you go to a party and you talk about climate change, and they're like, yeah, that guacamole was great over there, wasn't it? You know, it's like nobody wants to go into the topic. Of course, parties are not the best place for those kinds of conversations. And I often long for an environment where you could actually come and talk about it, and people wouldn't be put off and would be willing to, like, explore the topic a little bit. And so a couple of years ago, it was 2 years ago, last month, that we had the first salon. And it had happened because a couple months prior to that, at a Harvest of Peace, I don't know whether to talk about what a Harvest of Peace is, but Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche, who's the current head of Shambhala, gives an annual address to the international community. And it, his address happens in the context of a day of celebration called Harvest of Peace. And I wasn't at that one, but according to informed sources, Emily Takahashi, whose maiden name was Emily Keeling, and Keeling is a very significant name, and I'll get back to why. So Emily, she's also been a long-time practitioner and member of the Shambhala Sangha, and she got up and said, you know, she had this aspiration that she would like to start a salon to discuss climate change. And when I heard about that, I was like, yes, I'm there, and I've been to, I think, every meeting that's happened since then. And I now work with Emily and Chris Lincoln, and we're kind of like the three people who are kind of like charting the course of the salon at this point. So we had our first, we meet monthly. Let me give you that detail right now, and I would love to invite you all to come and join us. We meet the third Sunday of each month from 2 to 4 at the Shambhala Center in Boulder, in the community room, usually. And we have a presenter who presents on a topic. We've had topics of permaculture, sustainability, biomimicry, soil carbon sequestration, social justice, the Paris Agreement, and lots of different topics. So there's a main presenter, and then there's a question and answer period with that presenter, and we break for tea and food and stuff. And then we regather and talk about the topic, if there's more to be said about it, or general conversation about what we're doing in terms of climate change, or where we'd like to see the salon focus its energy next. On Earth Day of 2015, we had our first major event, which was, instead of just having our Sunday gathering, we decided to do a more major event in honor of Earth Day and to like try to magnetize more people to come in. And so we showed a movie, which was called The Wisdom to Survive. Climate Change, Capitalism, and Community. And then we had a panel discussion moderated by Bob Morehouse. And on the panel, we had Cher Manoukian, who was coming from the perspective of social justice. We had Agnes Au, who is a senior teacher in the Shambhala tradition. We had Brett Kincairn, who is a senior city planner for Boulder, and he's heading up their agenda for becoming carbon neutral. I can say more about that later, if you're interested. And who was the other person? Jeffrey Keel. And Jeffrey Keel is also a longtime Shambhala practitioner and also a senior climate scientist at NCAR, and he's also, interestingly enough, a Jungian analyst. And he's recently written a book about climate change and the Jungian analyst approach to it. And he's fascinating. All of the people were fascinating, actually. So that was our main event in 2015, and then this last summer, in August, we had a 2.5-day program called, entitled Living Beyond Hope and Fear, Social Confidence, and Climate Change. And we got about 175 participants for the weekend, which was really great. And that included a couple main presenters, Charya Adam Lobel, Meg Wheatley, who is a kind of nationally recognized organizational consultant. And then we had breakout sessions with people with various disciplines, and we did nature walks, and we had a panel, interfaith panel discussion led by Fletcher Harper on Sunday afternoon. And so we had the representatives from the Jewish tradition, the Catholic tradition, the Buddhist tradition, and the Islamic tradition, Sufi specifically. And Fletcher himself is the international executive director of the this international association called Green Faith. And it's, let me read about Green Faith. I have to refer to my notes a little bit. Green Faith has the mission of, our mission is to inspire, educate, and mobilize people of diverse religious backgrounds for environmental leadership. We believe that protecting the earth is a religious value and that environmental stewardship is a moral responsibility. He was fascinating, and he was a great moderator. So getting back to Emily Keeling, and why that's Emily Keeling Takahashi, is because in the science of climate, there's what's known as the Keeling curve. And have you all seen the Keeling curve? Emily's father was a climate scientist, and he wanted to measure. We knew that it was probable that carbon dioxide was building up in our atmosphere, but we didn't know how much, how fast. And so he spearheaded the movement to have these monitoring stations built on Mauna Loa in Hawaii. And so at the end of the 1950s, they started tracking
the buildup. Oh my goodness.
Don't go there. Of CO2. And I wish I had a PowerPoint presentation, but I don't know how to do PowerPoint. Anyway, starting in 1960, and this goes to 2015, I don't know if you can see it very well, but this is the Keeling curve. Can you see? It's like a... And
what's at the bottom axis? What's the bottom number?
Well, the bottom are the years, 1960, 65.
The bottom of the y axis. Yes.
The what?
The other axis. What's it measure?
How many?
I'm going to tell you. that's this is how much CO2 is building up.
It's parts per million.
Yeah, per million.
But the bottom is not zero, right?
No. It's 310. Okay. And so. Yeah, and now we're up to 405, and that's in 56 years, right?
The Keeling felt that in the 50s, CR predicted that CO2 buildup, which started at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, would affect climate. He pretty well predicted based on physics, and supposedly before the Industrial Revolution, the parts per million was 270. I have to check that out, but I think that's what I remember. Yeah. And supposedly the 400 parts per million mark was not going to be easily reversible. Mm-hmm. And we hit that a couple of years ago on Mauna Loa. But he found out something else very interesting, is that it wasn't a simple curve. Each year, depending on the season, it would vary some. So in North America, the arboreal forests of all of Siberia and North America during the summer absorbed a lot of CO2. And there's this one woman thinker on climate and environment called Diana Beresford Kroger. She calls it the lungs of the climate. And so you could see this little variance. Well, that arboreal forest is now on fire a lot. Yeah. And it's also moving farther north. And so the lungs of the earth, that kind of, if you want to call them that, are also diminishing.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, we should be using this, I guess.
So
right. So, now, yeah, there's this little zigzag. It looks like a sawtooth kind of thing. And yes, just like you said, it goes up. It goes up in the wintertime and down in the warmer, because more is being absorbed.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you want to, how much you want to hear about the science. And I just was reading about the science this week, and this is really fantastic. If you want to understand the science, and the skeptics, what the skeptics are saying about climate, they're a dying breed. And his answers to the skeptics. It's pretty much 97 or more percent of the scientists who've been surveyed on climate change say it's real, it's human caused, and it's a problem. And 3% say otherwise. No scientists, even the skeptics, argue with the physics of climate change. It's more how much of a threat it is. And some are saying it's not. The 3% are saying, well, we don't know how much of a threat it is. But I'm thinking if I wanted to invest in a stock, and I went to 100 stockbrokers, and 97% said, you should buy this. And 3% said, I wouldn't go near it. I would probably buy it. and this is another graph of the average global temperature of the planet, starting in 1880, which is when they started recording global temperatures, going up to 2015. And the 10, the 9 highest ratings, 9 highest global temperatures have been since 2000. One was 1998, and so that makes the 10th one, but the other 9 have been since 2000, and 2015 was the hottest on record. So,
And 2016 is supposed to be hot.
Yes. I heard President Obama say that October was the hottest October on record.
Can I just say one quick thing? The 30% that are denying climate change are doing so in a way that the tobacco industry started doing the denial of the relationship between cancer and tobacco. And the names of those people who created a sense of doubt, since they couldn't challenge the science, are known, and they're the same people who are creating the same principle in denying climate change to create doubt in such a way that people will not accept the obvious science. And so they're hired by the industry. Fossil fuel industry pretty much to continue that same strategy. So,
well, I won't say anything more about the science of this, but it's an interesting history. I mean, Catherine Hayhoe is a climate scientist in Texas, and she teaches at some university in Texas, and she's a very vocal spokeswoman for climate change. And interestingly enough, she's evangelical Christian, and she particularly reaches out to them to try to talk to them, because they're the toughest group to reach. But what was I going to say about her? Can't remember where I was going with that.
Guarding the creation?
I don't remember. Anyway, I'll just say a couple of things about her. She says on her website that only one in five Americans hear people they know talk about global warming at least once a month. This is according to a survey that was done by Yale. And she was asked, what's one of the most important things we can do about climate change? And she said, talk about it. So that's why the Climate Salon came into existence, and it's one of the things we do. But we're trying to do more than just talk about it. We're trying to take action as well. So getting back to the salon, we have a statement of intent. It's not exactly a mission statement, but and it goes. As Shambhala warriors, we train to join heaven and earth, inspiration and practicality. How can we bring our training to the challenge of joining the vision of enlightened society with the reality of climate change? So that's really what we're about, is like, how do we take what we're learning about ourselves through our meditation practice and about our planet, our environment, about our society, about our country and about our world. What are we learning about how to appreciate who we are, what we are, where we live, and how do we take action to preserve the beauty of the whole thing? So, Melanie Klein, who is the director of the Shambhala Center in Boulder, is really inspired by the salon, and as is Holly Gailey, who's one of the Shastris. And they have said, we're going to take this issue on as our issue, as the issue for Boulder. Boulder, the home of Noah, NCAR, 300 environmental groups, I've heard. We're going to take this issue on as an issue that we really want to focus on and understand and learn how to talk about amongst all of the Shambhala centers. So, you know, as I mentioned, we've connected with different groups in Boulder, and I wanted to mention who some of those groups are. One is the City of Boulder, and especially through Brett Kincairn, who's come to several of our meetings and was on our panel and also was a presenter at the symposium. And we also have made connections with C3. I'm just telling you in case you want to check these people out. You know, C3 is the Climate Cultural Collaborative, which is an organization in Boulder which is working with all the environmental groups to cross-pollinate, share ideas, gain inspiration, support each other. There's CCL, which is the Citizens Climate Lobby, and this is a national organization that works with friends, neighbors, communities, city officials, state and national legislators, congressmen. They actually go to Congress and meet with congressmen, senators, and talk about the issue of climate change. I think they're a very brave, probably very creative group of people. There's the Eco Dharma, which is another association of practice groups, Tibetan Zen insight meditation groups in Boulder who gather together to talk about climate change. Green Faith, which I mentioned, and the Joanna Macy Center. And do any of you know who Joanna Macy? Sounds like someone's heard of Joanna. Joanna is an environmental activist, author, scholar of Buddhism, general systems theory, and deep ecology. She's written several books. She's now 86 years old and going strong. And we take her as an inspiration. The Joanna Macy Center is now located at Naropa University, where she's become quite involved. And I wanted to put in a plug for her that she's going to be in Boulder. She's going to be doing, a week-long training at Naropa, but she's also going to come to the Shambhala Center on March 9th from 7 to 9. And I forget what her topic is, but it's about empowering ourselves, empowering community to enact change. So she's a very wonderful person and a very interesting teacher and lots of experience. And if you come to see her, you'll love her. She's just quite dynamic and engaging and funny. Trudy wanted me to make sure I said that.
Okay. I'll tell her again.
It's on the record. So I wanted to open this up as a conversation. So I'm curious about what people are thinking about climate change, and other than your two or three words, and I just want to hear from people. We have to relate to it. I mean, it's real, and it's moving fast. And John Holdren is a he is the senior advisor to President Obama on science and technology. And he said, we're going to relate to this issue in three ways. Mitigation, adaptation, and suffering. And we're going to do some of all of those. And in some way, it's going to be up to us how much we do of any one of those. If we don't do enough mitigation, we're going to have to do more adaptation. If we don't do enough mitigation and adaptation, we're going to be doing more suffering. So we have to decide where do we want to be on the spectrum and take action accordingly. So, does anybody have questions about anything I've said? Or do you want to hear more about any one of these particular issues, permaculture or anything like that?
Fine. I think those three points are really very important to hinge on, especially when we're working with our communities in the psychology of adaptation and contending with challenging weather events, extreme weather events, which we're having much more of in terms of, you know, raging storms being quite devastating, lots and lots of fire, quite devastating, whatever. That brings up, you know, the survival issues of our community, of our neighbors in our cities and our regions. And so we have there's a lot of work we can do with people and helping them to contend and cope with that kind of upheaval in their lives. It's very tangible, very real. Climate change is kind of part of the natural order anyway. But whether we can see it as being... climate is constantly in evolution and shifting. Right now it's shifting extremely in one direction, but we've had to, as humanity, we've had to contend with shifts. And sometimes we survive and sometimes we don't. So that's, you know, kind of where we're at, I think, with that.
The Anthropocene is the idea that this is now an age of human geological caused events. And if you just look at the satellite pictures of the Earth and the dark side of the Earth, you see almost the whole landmass is lit up. That's meaning that there's a lot of energy being burned. And that's all human activity since Edison promoted electrification. And I have this idea that I would dress up as Edison or somebody would.
You want to hold it a little closer?
And say, why are you still using old technology? Because he constantly reinvented himself. And the current state of green technologies is useful right now, as most of you probably know. And so we need to really promote that. There's a thinker named William McDonough that's talked about how we could design manufacturing systems to not pollute, and that includes carbon dioxide. And he says the goal of the upcycle, which is what he's talking about for good design, is a delightfully diverse, safe, healthy, and just world with clean air, water, soil, and power, economically, equitably, ecologically, and elegantly enjoyed. And he's created a foundation to certify products that are designed with that in mind. So with that theme, what he says is that if there's no end game for pollution, the end game is death. And then he says pollution is unintelligent design. And then he says it's also poor accounting because we end up cleaning up what other people leave behind. And either that or eat it. So I think there's direct implications of what we could do. And then there's these books which I don't want to talk about now.
But the Northwest Earth Institute has created discussion courses that are non-hierarchical that help promote change and understanding and change both. And like sustainability, peace, justice, and sustainability, eating in terms of sustainability for food, sustainable systems at work. And so there's a lot that could be done in promoting that here in Boulder, in Boulder County. And so there's a lot of potential for practical discussion.
I guess what I usually find is missing in these, in the way people talk about climate change, is the cause.
Oh, yes.
The cause. So Joanna Macy talks about the three ways to transform from an industrial growth society, which requires continuous growth in order to function. Otherwise, you have depression, which actually we can't continue because there's not enough earth to eat up anymore. The second thing is, the first thing is holding actions like mitigation. The second activity that we can engage in is building new systems, and you mentioned something about new systems. Mm-hmm. And the third action is consciousness, which is looking at the stories within ourselves that create this system and create what we're doing, which has to do with how we see ourselves and being disconnected from nature and disconnected from how we feel. I'm just noticing the silence in this room. I'm just feeling this is intense, for me anyway, intense frustration and rage and fear. And yet I go out into the world and it's like I'm pretending the world isn't going over a cliff. And we're all kind of afraid to even, like there's no room to have our experience about what's happening. So Joanna Macy's workshop, I highly recommend. I did one last year. And it has us do these exercises where you talk to somebody from 200 years in the future and you come into contact with your own goodness and your own depth of compassion and wisdom around what's happening, what you want for the planet. So it's a great way to take the energy we have inside of us and transform it into enlightened action. Not through thinking about it, but more like getting in touch with our bodily knowledge. And so I just want to put that out there, that there's the consciousness aspect that, mm-hmm. that can start with just having support structures where we allow ourselves to express how we feel about what's happening in the news. And it can be very liberating, and then it's not so, then the guilt goes away and the shame goes away, and it's just like, oh, okay, yeah, suffering, it hurts, but now I can do something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, can I just say a few words about Joanna Macy has done in the past these despair and empowerment workshops. It's like, boy, does that sound like fun. I mean, the second half is, but the first half is the despair. I mean, it's like, it's important to really get in touch with how you feel about what's happening. I mean, we numb ourselves out and we go along and try not to think too much into the future or look too deeply. But if you do, I mean, what I've found is you find that you can actually hold a lot of that. You can actually feel that stuff and let it be part of you and not shy away from, and it gives you some kind of strength, actually, that you can, well, let's just tackle this rather than instead of ignoring it, why don't we just like jump in and start to do something? Brett Kincairn, the Boulder City senior planner, when he was on the panel at our first Earth Day event, he said, climate change is not the problem. The problem is disconnection. And he went on to say, and all, as well as this consumer mentality, you know, that everything is here to be consumed. But I really resonate with the disconnection. It's because we're disconnected from our environment that we can destroy it. I mean, if you're really in touch with it, how could you destroy where you live? How could you destroy your forests and your oceans and your river? How could you do that? Only if you're not relating to it. Anyway, just wanted to highlight that. Because you use the term disconnection.
I was involved with the environmental movement in the 70s. I went to college and got a degree in environmental science and did this thing called Man and His Environment, which was a little agricultural school that was no longer being used as an agricultural school. And we went, we were the first cohort to go, and did a lot of things outside, did a lot of research, experimentation. So I sort of felt like I was smack in the middle of people's awakening, at least at that time. And then I kind of got more involved with more human-centric stuff and people having conflicts, so I got involved. I was a mediator for years and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, so now I find as I'm getting older that I'm coming back around to what I originally did, which was teaching environmental education. And I'm doing something called interpretation, which is, I guess, you know, if you think about it, it's probably the guy with the big hat in the national park that's telling you about, you know, beavers in their creeks or whatever, and he's got the skulls and he's got the pelt and he's got the, you know, maybe a taxidermy of a beaver or whatever. But the stuff that I've been running across in this interpretation stuff is kind of cool because it's really much more about connection. It's much more about connection. So it's not so much information-based as sort of giving people the opportunity to connect to their world.
Like sensorially.
Yeah, and a lot of different, of course, that's kind of my thing, too. I'm not really much on the facts and that kind of thing. It's much more give people a chance, especially kids, just give them a chance to just hang out. Nature will do what it needs to do, I think. It's a great teacher. But anyway, so it's kind of weird to be back. I don't know. You know, in some ways I feel kind of bad. It's like, well, I don't know, how much did we do? Well, you know, we did some stuff, and my generation anyway, of trying to make a difference. And but I realized, at least for myself, that it's always felt a bit like kind of taking a butter knife and scraping at a glacier. And I've just been scraping away for a long time, and I don't know how much difference I've made, but I don't know what else to say. But I don't feel particularly disappointed, but I don't really have a community to engage with about that. So because to me, it's much deeper what I'm trying to do. You know, we say, well, she's just, you know, going out talking about the bald eagles. But I know what I'm doing, at least trying to do. And it would be great to talk to other people about what they're doing, you know, get some support. So.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot going on. I mean, there are a lot of approaches. I mean, there's the hopeless aspect of this, but there's also the hopeful, which is that this conversation is growing, and it's growing rapidly. And people are doing really interesting and dynamic things. I mean, soil carbon sequestration is really taking off, and that is really a big deal. And you know, alternative energy is really coming to the fore. A friend was telling me today, that solar and wind is now competitive with fossil fuels. So that's a big deal. And I, you know, when I do get into how hopeless, I have to remember all of the things that are happening and on this huge wave that's like moving across the planet of people who are very concerned, very aware, and very motivated. So I just want to put that out there. I'd like, okay. We don't all have to say something, but we can. I want to hear from this side of the room too, you know, so. But I want to hear from you.
I think it's important to recognize what we have been doing in the last 50 years.
Oh, did you want to say something, Paul? You see, Dan? Or Dan? Dan, do you want to say something?
I will, yeah.
Okay.
But not
in the middle of something else.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting, George, that you're saying hopelessness counterweighted by hopefulness. I will guarantee you that I am the biggest pessimist in this room, and we are right in the middle of a mass extinction right now. There have been many mass extinctions on Earth, and we're right in the middle of one right now. And my problem is I get the gestalt of things, but I don't get the details, so I can't necessarily give you specific details. But one of the things that hasn't been mentioned is the alkalinity and the acidity of the oceans. Mm-hmm. And of course, the oceans are what drive our climate, basically the sun and the oceans. And the oceans are becoming an extinction reservoir for many, many species. Mm-hmm. And it just baffles me to think that wind farms and carbon dioxide sequestration are going to have any effect on reversing what has already happened in the oceans and the driving of this extinction is going on right now. So I'd like to be hopeful, but I haven't been hopeful for the last 15 or 20 years.
Well, George, when I heard about all the different groups, I thought about the children in the community, because it seems that the education and getting children very, especially middle school, they're still pretty impressionable. They have enough cognitive ability to understand a problem, and if they have simple lifestyle ways that they can live, things they need to do to make a change in how they live, that's the group that could be from the bottom up, because it's hard to make a change from the top down right now. Mm-hmm. It's going to get harder. But, you know, certainly through the libraries and the schools and the WISE and other organizations, it sounds like you have enough people, I'm new to this area, that could provide a lot of education. So that's what came up to my mind.
I do think that getting, you know, being able to get climate change back into the topic of conversation would be something that would be very great for, I mean, I'm just new to this area also, but back where I'm from in New York, encountered a lot of people that found, or at least thought, that humans were the priority. I mean, in some sense, we are, and that we can make the most change, and we've made the most negative change so far. But I worked with shorebirds and some other endangered species back in Long Island, and I found that a lot of people thought of themselves in priority, that if there was a nesting bird or something in front of their property, they asked to either move it or they would for rocks at it to disturb their nest so they would move so that they could enjoy their own personal space and not think about what's coming.
So I think I probably have a question first, and then I'll let them 2 cents on the something. So as a bodhisattva, I think for me, I look for immediate tools and resources to have the same enlightened conversations, but with a environmental edge to them. So I guess one of the things I'm wondering about is, as a byproduct of the efforts of the salon and the conversations that the salon is cultivating, do you think there's going to be either a sheet or a primer or something that's talking points for all of us that are the peace warriors?
The peace warriors?
Is there a tool or teachings that are coming out that I think could be universally shared by all of us in the Shambhala community?
On the topic of climate change.
On the topic of climate change.
Well, I hope so. I hope that can come out of this salon, you know. Maybe we should talk. I'd like to hear if you have some ideas about that. I think the Shambhala teachings are a good vehicle already. And if we can weave the topic of climate change into it, I think that's what we have to figure out. We have to figure that out. And I'd like to have something like that.
That, in my mind, I would be very excited to see that be a byproduct of these discussions and these efforts. Mm-hmm. I do work in a space. My whole career has been dedicated to renewable energy. Mm-hmm. I sell solar systems, utility-scale solar, to utilities around the country, and have been involved with environmental and renewable policy for over 20 years. So it's a very fatiguing industry to be in. But it's also a very hopeful place to be most of the time. Mm-hmm. Like everybody in this room, obviously, with the most recent election, you know, we question all the work that's been, the good work that's been done for decades, but mm-hmm. Still hopeful because there's a lot of passionate people like everybody in this room that cares and can bring it down to a very personal level. So I think there's commitment. Every day, I do transactions with utilities around the country. They get the need for renewable energy as one way to counter what's happening. But we make the business case now every day for solar and wind and a variety of other clean technologies. So for that economic reason, we're making the case faster for adoption of better technology. So for that reason, I'm incredibly hopeful mm-hmm. that we can make faster change.
Mm-hmm. Hate to be the bearer of bad tidings, but we have to wrap up.
Well, we have to let Dan speak.
Okay.
Sorry. I mean, we have 3 minutes here.
Okay.
Don't we?
We do.
Yeah.
Since I'm suffering from a little low blood sugar, but also wanted to, as best as I could, been thinking a lot about what's going on and how there's there's a lot of powerlessness, and I'm thinking that one of the major things about what's going on these days is this need to kind of sit with this and sort of bear witness to this breakdown that's going on, and obviously I don't think I can be coherent.
You're doing good.
Yeah, there's probably a lot that's a lot of the energy. There's this energy of the energies these days are around breakdown and around and while this destruction is going on,
sugar in the brain, it's hard.
Well, we should probably stop. Right?
Yes.
Well, thank you all for coming. I'm glad we got this conversation started. This is what excites me, is the fact that people come together and share these ideas and the hope and the hopelessness, and it's all part of it, you know. And rather than being hopeless or hopeful, we should, I just try to be open. Let's just be open. We don't know. We really don't know where this whole thing is going.